Good evening, everybody. So we'll continue on from where we were last week. So we'll continue on with the Bodhisattva vows. We covered all the ones regarding wisdom last time, didn't we? Oh, so we only finished up, only up to 34. Okay, so, so we finished the one on wisdom, and then we just have the ones for benefiting, the ethical conduct of benefiting others. So we'll continue from there, and then we'll go into the six perfections more completely. I was using the term six far-reaching attitudes for many years, as you'll know. It's Alice's term, and for the Tibetan, which is Paro Du Chin, means to like go beyond, and so far-reaching seemed like a good translation. And I always wondered about translating it as perfection, because it the word perfection kind of bothers me. Like, what does it mean? I don't really understand what perfection means exactly. And I wasn't sure that it had an etymological basis for it. But when I was writing Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions, the editor at Wisdom said, everybody uses the word perfection. Nobody understands far-reaching practices, you know. And hardly, he didn't know about us. And and then he sent me, you know, like a dictionary, a Sanskrit dictionary thing, and I saw that, perfection is one of the meanings of the Sanskrit word paramita. Mm-hmm. Yeah, meaning that it's actually the Buddhas that have perfected everything, you know, meaning completely purified those different ways of thinking and acting and brought them to their fruition, you know, with all good qualities. So that's kind of the meaning of perfection. So then he talked me into using perfection again in the book. Mm-hmm. So I'll use both terms off and on, probably. Okay, so we'll start with we'll start with just a few minutes of breathing meditation to stop the mind from swaying. And then we'll do the practices like we always do. And in the space in front, visualize the merit field with all the holy beings, as you've been doing, and yourself surrounded by all the sentient beings in human form. And especially think of the people that you don't like in the space, you know, in front of you, so you have to see them in order to see the holy beings and make peace with them in your minds. let's think that we're leading all the sentient beings in doing the recitations and generating the corresponding feelings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free of suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings not be separated from sorrowless bliss. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind, and present clouds of every type of offering, actual and mentally transformed. I confess all my destructive actions accumulated since beginningless time, and rejoice in the virtues of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until cyclic existence ends, and turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. I dedicate all the virtues of myself and others to the Great Awakening. Then let's offer the universe and everything beautiful in it to show how much we value the Dharma. This ground anointed with perfume, flowers strewn Mount Meru, four lands, sun and moon, imagined as the Buddha land and offered to you. May all beings enjoy this pure land. Venerable space of your truth body, from billowing clouds of your wisdom and love, let fall the rain of the profound and extensive Dharma in whatever form is suitable for subduing sentient beings. Glorious and precious Root Guru, sit upon the lotus and moon seat on my crown. Guide me with your great kindness. Bestow upon me the attainments of your body, speech, and mind. The eyes through whom the vast scriptures are seen, supreme doors for the fortunate who would cross over to spiritual freedom, illuminators whose eyes meet vibrate with compassion, to the entire line of spiritual mentors I make request.
Taya Tamani Mani Mahamuni Soma Taya Tayata Om Mani Mani Mahamuni Soha. Tayata Om Taya ta mani mani maha mani so.
And so think with the guru on your head. Guru Buddha, please inspire me and all sentient beings so that once we have generated the wish for supreme awakening in its aspiring and engaging forms, we may train in the Bodhisattva precepts. And think, for the sake of all mother sentient beings, may I quickly attain complete and perfect Buddhahood. For that purpose, from now until I attain the essence of awakening, I shall keep the ethical code of the conqueror's children, train in their vast activities, and for the sake of all sentient beings attain Buddhahood. May I maintain this intention until I do indeed realize Buddhahood. All Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, please listen. Just as the Sugatas of the past generated bodhicitta and trained step by step in the Bodhisattva precepts, I too, for the sake of sentient beings, will generate bodhicitta and train step by step in the Bodhisattva precepts. Today my life has become fruitful. I have successfully attained a human life. Today I have been born into the Buddha's family and have now become a child of the Buddha's. From now on, whatever I do will be in harmony with that family. I will do nothing to taint this unsullied family of kindness. O Guru Buddha, please inspire me and all sentient beings to be able to train correctly in both aspects of the Bodhisattva's deeds, vast and profound. In response to your requesting the Guru Buddha, five colored light and nectar stream from all the parts of his body into you through the crown of your head. And similarly, Buddhas on the crowns of the heads of all the sentient beings around you stream light and nectar into those sentient beings as well. It absorbs into your body and mind and into the bodies and minds of all sentient beings. It purifies all your negativities and obstructions accumulated since beginningless time. And especially it purifies all illness, interferences, negativities, and obstructions that interfere with training correctly in the Bodhisattva's deeds and in the vast and profound Bodhisattva's deeds. Your body becomes translucent, the nature of light. All your good qualities, lifespan, merit, and so forth expand and increase. This is happening for all the sentient beings as well. Think in particular that a superior realization of correct training in both aspects of extensive bodhisattva deeds, vast and profound, has arisen in your mind stream and in the mind streams of all others. Okay, so we've been going through the Bodhisattva precepts. We went through the four, that for aspiring bodhicitta, so our bodhicitta doesn't degenerate in this life, and then the four to do and four to abandon, so our bodhicitta doesn't degenerate in future lives. Then we did the 18 root Bodhisattva precepts, and now we're in the middle of doing the 46 secondary bodhisattva precepts. So those 46 are broken up according to the six perfections or six paramitas, and then there's a group at the end that's especially about the ethical conduct of benefiting sentient beings. So we've done the ones for generosity, ethical conduct, fortitude, joyous effort, concentration, and wisdom, and now we're starting at number 35 of the auxiliary ones, and these are the ones, the ethical conduct of benefiting sentient beings. So these are very, very practical. So things to abandon, okay, not helping those who are in need. Yeah, so if somebody needs help, and requests our help, or even if they don't request it and we see that they really need help, then to step up to the plate and help as we can. Of course, if the kind of help they need is something that we can't give, they need you to lift 250-pound boulders and you can't manage that, then it's no transgression of this precept. But this is really, stepping up to the plate and helping when others need help. I mean, this is kind of the fundamental thing of all religions, isn't it? And even secular ethics. The idea that we are an interconnected community, and so, as much as we support the community supports us because we're all interconnected. Yeah? So having the idea, and we see this especially here living at the Abbey, having the idea that other people should do the work because I have more important things to do, that doesn't fly, because if everybody thought that way, then the place would shut down. Yeah, because the essential work wouldn't be getting done. And second of all, to do work, to offer service is a way of accumulating merit, which we desperately need. And it's a way of putting our Dharma practice, our meditation practice into practice, otherwise we sit on the cushion. We're very good at radiating lots of light to sentient beings and imagining them becoming Manjushri and Yamantaka. And we can do that for hour on end and feel very blissful, but as soon as somebody asks us for help, no thank you, we can't do that. You know, they should be helping us. So you know, if we see that our mind is thinking like that, then we see that, you know, something in our meditation practice isn't clicking. You know, it's remaining very much at the intellectual level. Yeah? These ones at the end here, they're all about stepping out and doing something. Yeah? So they're challenging to us, you know? I mean, it's hard enough to sit on your cushion and get a clear visualization and radiate light. But that's kind of nice. You can sit on your cushion and radiate light. And nobody's bugging you. Yeah? But when you have to get off your cushion and do something, then the mind can very easily say, why do I, should I have to do this? Everybody else uses the toilet too. Why do I have to be the one to clean the toilet? Yeah, they should clean my toilet. Why? Because it's mine, and I'm the best, and I'm the highest. We've been doing that since beginningless time. Where's it gotten us? Yeah, in the toilet. Yeah, right smack in the toilet. So we really need to. Yeah. Then 36, another thing to avoid is not taking care of the sick. Okay, so somebody doesn't feel well, you know, here at the Abbey, you know, your roommate or whoever it is doesn't feel well, and it's like, why do I have to bring a tray to them in their room? You know, they can come and get it. They're not that sick. Yeah, it sure would be nice if they brought a tray to me in my room sometimes. Right? Wouldn't it? Okay. So again, you know, not caring for the sick, just somebody's sick, well, you know, it's their karma. Let them sleep it off. You know, I was really touched when I was in Taiwan in 86 to receive the Bhikshuni precepts. The temple was very kind to the foreigners, and there were, I don't know, maybe a dozen, about a dozen, 15 of us. And they took us around the island on a kind of a temple tour. And one of the places we went was Venerable Chung Yen. She's the founder of Suchi Foundation. So this was back in 86. It wasn't as big as it is now. But they took us to the hospital on the east coast of Taiwan that she had started. And you walk into the hospital, and instead of seeing all the plaques with the donors' names, so that you can go, oh, look who's rich, you know, I just remember you walk in, and on this side, huge, huge picture of the Buddha taking care of a sick monk. Yeah? Because that actually happened at the time of the Buddha. Some of the other monks didn't want to take care of one sick monk. And so the Buddha went and took care of him. Yeah? And so this was, you know, Venerable Chung Yen's real thing of, you know, act like the Buddha and do something like this. And you can see she's been so wonderfully successful in bringing people together to step out and be of benefit in places where there's natural disasters and so on. Okay, then 37, not alleviating the suffering of others. Okay, so if somebody is sick or distressed or suffering in some way, doing what we can to alleviate their suffering. Okay, we shouldn't take this as, you know, I'm Mr. and Miss Fix It, and I've got to go around and fix everybody else's suffering. It isn't talking about that, okay? Because we tend to become Mr. and Ms. Fix-It, and say, I'm going to fix your problems, just do this, and I'm going to fix your problems and do that. Yeah? And that is much more of a condescending attitude. Yeah? Here it's, you know, somebody's suffering, and we just step out and do what we can to help. Yeah. So, of course, it's something, you know, that you need to balance with everything else you're doing, because, you know, it doesn't mean that you completely ignore yourself, make yourself a basket case because you're running around to benefit others all the time. Okay. Because then we fall apart, and then that doesn't do anybody else any good. Yeah. But when we're able to, yeah, and also when the person is able to accept the help, that's an important part of it, because some people, when they're unhappy or when they're suffering, you have to know how to approach them to be able to actually benefit, because there's a good deal of, I don't know if it's the word pride or their feeling of independence, you know? And so if you come in, well, I'll give you an example, okay? When my dad went, you know, he's gone now, but when he was, you know, quite old, because he lived to 93, so when he was quite old and, you know, he would be getting in and out of the car, he didn't like me to help him so much. You know, because it made him feel old, yeah? And he didn't like when we asked him to stop driving because it took away his independence. That one we had to push a bit on because, you know, for the safety of others. But it was quite interesting watching him because he didn't want me to help him, but my friends would come over and visit, and he would let my friends help him, yeah? And so I just had to learn in those situations, okay, I have to step back because he doesn't want to appear in front of his daughter to need help. But my friends are friendly and they're you know, and like that, so he's okay accepting help from them. Okay, so you have to see, you know, who's open to receiving help, who's not. Sometimes we're just not the right person to give the help. Yeah, people can't receive it from us for whatever reason, sometimes because we're quite close, yeah? And, you know, like with my dad in that situation. So, you know, to help when we can, but not to push ourselves on others. Okay, then 38, yeah, to abandon not explaining what is proper conduct to those who are reckless. Okay, so when people are acting in a reckless way, when they're creating negative karma, either because they're doing something that creates negative karma or their speech is creating negative karma, to try and explain what is proper conduct to those people. Now here we have to be careful because our ego can very easily get involved and we go around correcting everybody. Yeah, I'm going to tell you what proper conduct is, you know, and then I'm going to tell you what proper conduct is, and you what, and all the proper conduct, of course, corresponds to what I want other people to do. So that's not what we're talking about here. Yeah, if somebody's creating negative karma, or somebody doesn't know, you know, what manners are, what proper etiquette is in a situation, you know, then to go and approach them and help them and try and, you know, help them to understand so that they don't create negative karma and they can create some positive karma. It takes a great deal of skill to do this, yeah, because some people are like so appreciative when you go, like when we have people come to the Abbey who are brand new, most of them are really very appreciative if we say, you know, do this and don't do that, because they want to act properly and they don't know how. But we all still have to be delicate with them, because if they get the feeling like we're correcting them because they're bad, then they don't like it. But if we do it with an attitude of helping them, then they like it. They accept it, you know. Sometimes the people who have been around are much more difficult. Yeah, because they've been around a while, so they think they know everything. And so then when you try and point things out to them.
Yeah.
you know. So it's a delicate balancing act there, isn't it? Okay, then 39, and not benefiting in return those who have benefited us. Okay, so people who have benefited us, either, you know, because they've been benefactors, or they have helped us in some way, yeah, or they have taught us the Dharma, or they have, you know, in whatever, there's so many different ways that people benefit us, then to just take their benefit for granted without doing anything to benefit them in return. Okay? So this can happen because of pride, thinking, you know, they benefit me, so I'm superior, and, you know, I don't go and benefit them. When we return the benefit, it doesn't mean we have to help them in the way that they help us, but we have to help them in some way. Okay? Let me give you an example. There's sometimes people are just so incredibly kind to the Abbey and generous with the Abbey and giving, you know, things to us and helping us materially. But the way we support them, the way we benefit them in return, is by giving teachings, by holding retreats, by making the place available for them to come and practice together, by offering counseling and doing all these other things. It doesn't mean that because they give us things, then we turn around and give them the same things back. Yeah, but we help in another way that is corresponding. And so that's quite important, you know, to be aware of who people who benefit us and to repay that kindness. Usually, our mind thinks of the people we have benefited and how they aren't repaying our kindness. Yeah, I did this for them, I did that for them. Then they criticize me in return. Then they do this in return. That's the wrong way to think, you know. Can you imagine, you know, Manjushri or Kuan Yin sitting there going, you know, I worked so hard on the Bodhisattva path for these people. And now they walk in the room and they don't even bow. Oh, they can't even do that, you know. So, I mean, that's just a simple, silly example. But the idea is when we give, not to expect anything in return. Yeah, but we should be very aware of what people have done to help us and do what we can to repay that kindness. Yeah, in some way or another. Yeah, according to the situation. Then 40 is not relieving the sorrow of others. So if people, you know, somebody has died, their marriage is broken up, you know, they lost their job or something like this. Again, it doesn't mean that their sorrow is our responsibility and we have to fix their emotions. What it means is, you know, if they need some help and some counseling to be able to, you know, look at their loss in a different way, that we reach out and we give that, you know, again with kindness. Wanting to alleviate their sorrow. 41, not giving material possessions to those in need. So again, it doesn't mean that we are able to meet the material needs of everybody, but when it's possible and somebody's in need of something and we have it, then to give. Yeah. So to really overcome our own miserliness. Of course, when we give, we have to give something that's suitable, and we have to give something that belongs to us. If it doesn't belong to us, and let's say it belongs to the Abbey community, as an individual, we can't give it. Okay? So, you know, we should check with others in those kind of situations. Then 42, not working for the welfare of one's circle of friends, students, employees, helpers, etc. Okay, so the people who are immediately around us, to try and benefit them, you know, either our friends, yeah, if you're a teacher, your student, if you're a student, then your fellow students, yeah, employees, helpers, colleagues, you know, whoever is immediately around you, to do what we can to work for their welfare, yeah. And so this is, for example, you know, that we hear of some people who are, you know, just incredibly involved in charity work for, you know, people on the other side of the world, and they do wonderful work, but their own kids never see them, yeah, and their own family is kind of neglected. So, you know, this is to balance that. Yes, do what we can for others who are far away, but let's remember to take care of the people that are immediately around us. Okay? And like I was saying sometime recently, you know, we're the people in their lives, and we can often influence them in ways that the Dalai Lama and Mother Teresa can't, because we're in the lives of those people, so we can say things and do things that can be of direct benefit to them. Okay, then 43, not acting in accordance with the wishes of others if doing so does not bring harm to oneself or others. This one's a little bit dicey, okay? So basically it's saying, you know, when we can go along with the wishes of others, as long as it doesn't harm oneself or harm other people. In other words, you know, don't be one of these people who always is, it's got to be my way. It's my way or the highway. Yeah? We either cook the food this way or forget it. Or, you know, kind of somebody who's not very cooperative and always has to have things done their way. So to not be like that, yeah, and to go along with the wishes of others. But there's caveats here. First is that it doesn't bring harm to ourself. So here's where it gets confusing, yeah? You're visiting your family. Yeah. They want to take you on a cruise, yeah, or they want to take you on a vacation somewhere. And they mean well, and, you know, they want to be with you, but you know if you accept their generous offer of going on vacation, that your mind is going to completely lose the Dharma energy that you've been building up. Yeah? So in that kind of situation, it's okay to turn them down. Yeah? Because that is something that would really damage your practice. Yeah? Or somebody invites you out to the pub. This is where people get really, you know, where the ability to use compassion as a rationalization comes in. Yeah? My friends asked me out to the pub, or they asked me to smoke a joint. And this number 43 says, not acting in accordance with the wishes of others, so I should act in accordance with their wishes and drink and drug with them. And, you know, because if I don't, they'll think that Buddhism is really, Buddhists are very prudish and, you know, are very boring and no fun to be with. And if I, you know, I'll just drink a little bit, I'll just, you know, smoke a little bit. And then I can share the Dharma with them because they'll trust me, I'll be one of them, I can share the Dharma. This is bodhisattva work. Right. Yeah? So, you know, using compassion as a rationalization to, you know, give in to our attachment. So that's not what this precept is about, okay? So it has to be something that doesn't harm you physically or harm your Dharma practice, or something that, it can't be something that's going to harm somebody else either, okay? So somebody wants you to go hunting with them. You don't have to shoot any animals, you know, but you can help them carry the deer back and put it in the car, or, you know, something like that. No, thank you, I'm not doing that. Okay, so it's basically kind of, the point is to cooperate with others as much as we can and not be like stubborn and, you know, it's got to be my way, but not to go to the other extreme and use this to rationalize what our ego wants to do either. Okay, so these things are all very practical. We face these situations on a daily basis. So it really, you know, takes some time to think about them, you know, and what to do and how to deal with these kinds of things. Then 44, not praising those with good qualities. Yeah, so it's very good, you know, part of the bodhisattva practice is to be able to praise others. So this is kind of the opposite of jealousy. There were several bodhisattva precepts before that we covered that had to do with how we act out of jealousy. But this one is, you know, when we eliminate jealousy, then to be able to look and praise other people. And I think it's actually very good for our Dharma practice, because the more we learn to praise, the happier our own mind is. Whereas the more we pick out other people's faults, the more unhappy our mind is. It's true, isn't it? Yeah? The more it's like they do this wrong and they do that wrong and I don't like this and I don't like that, we're basically digging ourselves a ditch of unhappiness. Whereas when we're able to look at a situation or look at other people with good qualities and really rejoice in those qualities, then our own mind feels quite uplifted. I always think of this one, you know, because monastics, we sit in ordination order, yeah. And so when I was living in India, one of the nuns who was, which she was on this side of me, yeah, she was very, very difficult. Yeah, really difficult. And and other people agreed. So you see, it's not just me and my projection about her, but she's really like this because other people also thought she was jealous that she was there. You were there. You know who I'm talking about, don't you? Yeah, wasn't she difficult? Yeah. Yeah, see, Mary Grace was there. She agrees. She knows this person. Yes. You know, so it's interesting because, you know, I could look at this one on this side. She was very difficult. The one on this side was also difficult. Not quite as bad as the one on this side, but she was also difficult. Okay, and here we are at this conference and I'm running around. I'm doing so much to benefit sentient beings and I'm sitting in between these two difficult people. Yeah. You see how much I suffer? you know, I just remember so often in those days, you know, you look this way in the line and like that person does that wrong and that person does that wrong and that person has this fault and that person and this person and that person. You know? So you look up the line and all you see is faults and you look down the line and all you see is faults. Okay? And then you know that your mind is changing and your practice is being effective when you could look up the line and rejoice in their good qualities and look down the line and rejoice in their good qualities instead of being jealous, instead of picking out their faults, but really appreciating their good qualities. And then it just makes us so much happier when we can do that. Okay, then 45, not acting with whatever means are necessary according to the circumstances to stop someone who is doing harmful actions. Okay, so whenever, if somebody is actively doing harmful actions, to intercede as we're able to, yeah, again, there has to be sensitivity for the situation. I think I told you when I lived near Green Lake in Seattle, I would see people fishing, and, you know, as much as I would like to go up to them and say, you know, these fish want to live as much as you do, and you're just creating negative karma by fishing. I couldn't do that, you know, that wouldn't have worked very well, okay? But when there's other situations, you know, to intercede in some way or another, to stop somebody who's doing something harmful. And so one good way to do this is to change the topic or to do something very surprising, yeah? And it can often change, you know, a dynamic. A friend once invited me to have dinner with his parents, who had been married, you know, I don't know how many years. So you know how old married couples are, and, you know, they enact the same kind of scene again and again. And so, you know, although I didn't know his parents well, I could feel that there was some friction. And so I just kind of took what one of them said and then led the topic and, you know, took that word but led the topic in another way. And my friend said to me afterwards, he said, "That was really good. I have to remember to do that." Mm-hmm. Yeah? And so I've really noticed that so often when you can see something going in a bad direction, you just take one word somebody said and you lead the conversation in another direction. Yeah? Or we had one person, did some of you remember Ulrich and his mother? His mother was a character. I wish I could remember some of the stories that she said, that she told me, but she was amazing what she would do. You know, she would see, you know, kind of a situation in public of a man, you know, starting to beat his wife, and she just jumped in and did something in the middle of it that completely, you know,
discombobulated
everybody. Yeah? I mean, I can't remember what she did. I really should get some of these stories. But I was so impressed because she was really kind of fearless. Yeah, somebody was doing something negative and she just went in and did something, you know. Yeah. Okay. And then 46, not using miraculous powers if one possesses this ability in order to stop others from doing unwholesome actions. So if you have, you know, clairvoyant powers or some kind of miraculous powers and you can use them to benefit somebody, then you should do so. But you should never use them to show off to other people. And if you do use them, you should be discreet about it so that other people don't go afterwards, this person, you know, can do this and that. Okay, so those are the auxiliary bodhisattva precepts. Okay. So we'll go into the six perfections now. So I wanted to first talk about the six far-reaching practices in general. Sometimes we talk about 10. If we talk about 10, the last four are subdued in the sixth one. In the Pali tradition, they also have 10 paramis. Some of them overlap with the Mahayana 10 paramitas, and some of them are different. Okay, but whether they're the same or different, the ones that are unique in each tradition are practiced in some other way in the other tradition. Okay? So, to first talk about them in general, that the six perfections are needed first to accomplish the welfare of other sentient beings. Second, to achieve the purpose of ourself and the purpose of others. And the third, to be able to have a precious human life in the future so that we'll be able to continue to practice and attain full awakening. Okay, so the first, to accomplish the welfare of other sentient beings, that's what you do after you've attained Buddhahood. The second one, to fulfill the purpose of yourself and others, that is completed when you attain Buddhahood. And then the third one, to attain a precious human life, is to what you do before you attain Buddhahood, because we need a precious human life as the basis on which to be able to keep practicing. Yeah, that's the most immediate thing. If we don't have a good rebirth, then, you know, we can't do anything. Okay. Nagarjuna speaks about this a lot in the first chapter of Precious Garland, so you'll hear it soon. Okay, it's quite beautiful the way he talks about it. Okay, so to accomplish the welfare of others, we need the six practices. Okay, so giving, so we have to give the baits, because when we do the six, yeah, it gives the basic necessities to others. Okay, so yeah, so it's going through each one by one and shows how and showing how it accomplishes the welfare of others. So giving fulfills the basic needs of others. Okay, ethical conduct is refraining from harming them. Yeah, so that clearly benefits them. So this is always a difficult thing, you know, because so often we don't mean to harm others, at least we think we don't mean to, but we're not aware of how our actions affect other people. And so our actions do become harmful. So it's you know, a thing of developing conscientiousness and seeing how our actions affect others. And also looking a little bit deeper and seeing sometimes if there's some negative motivation kind of lurking around in there. I don't know about you, but I know very well how to cover up my negative motivations by making it sound like I'm doing a Dharma action. Okay, so. Then the third one, patience or fortitude is necessary because others misbehave. So we need to be able to, you know, have fortitude in the face of whatever disappointment or suffering or whatever kind of thing comes our way. We need a joyous effort so that we can continue to benefit them in a continuous way. Okay, we need meditative stability, you know, the deep states of concentration, because those, starting with the fourth jhana and going upwards, that's when you attain these different super knowledges and miraculous powers. So you need that kind of meditative stability to give you, that gives us the ability to have more powers and, you know, to actually be able to directly benefit others. And then we need wisdom in order to teach others the path to liberation and awakening. Okay, so that's how those six accomplishes the six, that's how the six accomplish the welfare of other sentient beings. Okay, then to fulfill our own purpose, we want to be free of all faults and attain liberation and enlightenment. And the one factor that enables that is wisdom. So we need wisdom. Okay. To develop right wisdom, we need deep concentration. Because if we can't concentrate, then we can't put our mind on a virtuous object. And without putting our mind with wisdom on that virtuous object, we can't eliminate the defilements from our mind. And then to develop concentration, we need joyous effort to overcome our laziness in practice. Okay, so the last three perfections are said, you know, in this way of explaining them. There's other ways of explaining them, but in this way are said to fulfill our own purpose, because they help us purify our mind and attain the Dharmakaya. Yeah, so this is they fulfill our purpose. It's completing the collection of wisdom, which is the principal cause for the Dharmakaya. Then to fulfill others' purpose, The first three paramitas are especially for fulfilling the purpose of others. So they all center around ethics. Yeah. So if we're attached to our own possessions, like our body or our possessions, then we will harm others to procure more possessions and to protect them. Okay? So we need generosity in order to have good ethical conduct, because by developing delight in giving, then we aren't so possessive of things, and so then we don't create so much negative karma to procure and protect them. Then if we get angry, then it's difficult to live ethically, because our mouth and our body just enact our anger and spurt it out on all the, you know, whoever happens to be in the vicinity. So we need fortitude in order to counteract our anger to, again, live ethically. So it's interesting if you look at it and you see ethics, which is the second one, as the central thing, okay? So what disturbs our ethics? Attachment and anger. To counteract the attachment that makes us create negative karma, we develop generosity. Then we don't create, we're able to live ethically better without the attachment to possessions and body and so on. Anger disturbs our ethical conduct, so we practice fortitude, because that keeps our mind stable and calm. And then again, we don't create so much negative karma. Okay, so quite interesting, isn't it? Yeah, to see how generosity is the thing there. So also through generosity, another way it fulfills others' purpose is generosity makes people happy. Okay? If we want to benefit them, it attracts others to us, you know? So, you know, if you want to teach people the Dharma, they have to be attracted to you. Being generous, and it could be physical, you know, giving gifts, or it could be giving praise, or it could be, you know, and giving friendliness. Generosity can be expanded to be many, many different things. But by being generous to others in some way or another, it attracts them to us, and then that enables us to really work for their benefit and to teach them the Dharma. Okay, so we need generosity to fulfill others' purpose in that way. Then if we harm others, even though we practice generosity, our generosity doesn't become full-fledged virtue, because as soon as we're generous, we go and harm the people we were generous to. Okay, so in order to stop harming them, we need the second perfection with this ethical conduct. So we need to behave well so that others are impressed and come to us, you know, and then in that way it again opens the door for us to be able to benefit them. If we don't keep good ethical conduct and we're always criticizing and insulting and blabbering and saying who knows what, then people are going to look at us and like, okay, I think I'll go over this way and talk to somebody else. And then, you know, we aren't able to benefit them in any way, yeah? Because our you know, without the ethical conduct, they aren't attracted to us, okay? And then to practice generosity and ethics well, we need fortitude, because if we're generous to others and then they're not grateful after we give them something, then we might get very angry at them and scold them or retaliate. And then that would harm them, and it also violates our own ethical conduct. Okay, so if we practice the patience of the fortitude of non-harming, that also improves our ethical conduct. Okay? So you can see how generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude really achieve the purpose of others. And, you know, to attain the form body of the Buddha, that's the principal cause for that, is the collection of merit. And then the first three paramitas, or perfections, are how we collect merit through generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude. Yeah? So you have to go out, and you're going out and doing something. If you look at the, you know, at this way of dividing them, in the last three, to fulfill your own purpose, you're really concentrating on concentration and wisdom, developing those in your own meditation session. But we can't get to enlightenment by the collection of wisdom alone. We also need the collection of merit. And so, it's the collection of merit that is why the Bodhisattva path is so long. Yeah, it's not the collection of wisdom, it's the collection of merit. Because the hearers also realize the same emptiness. They can, they do it in a quicker time, can attain arhatship, quicker. Bodhisattva and the paramita jnana path, there's three countless great eons. What are you doing? You're not only collecting wisdom, but you've got to do meritorious actions. Okay? So, that's why bodhisattvas continue to be reborn in samsara. One is so that they can directly benefit the rest of us, and second is so that they can create the merit that will enable them to attain full awakening. Yeah, and specifically the form bodies of the Buddha. Okay. And then the third reason, we had the three reasons for needing all six was to benefit, to work for the welfare of sentient beings. The second one was to achieve our own purpose and others' purpose. And then the third was to attain a precious human life and to be able to use that precious human life in a really good way. So here we also need all six of the far-reaching practices to attain a series of precious human lives in the future. And if one of them is missing, then we won't have a fully ripened precious human life. Yeah, something will be missing in our precious human life. And so you can hear. Yeah. So because we want to practice Dharma, to attain enlightenment, then we need a precious human life in the future. So it's necessary to practice generosity, because in order to practice the Dharma, we need resources. Yeah? Because we want to, we want to make dana, you need resources to travel, you need resources, to set up an altar, you need food, you need clothing, you need, to be able to stay alive. So you need resources in your next life to be able to practice. How do we create the cause to have the resources we need to be able to practice the Dharma in future life? By being generous in this life. Okay? So generosity creates the cause so that in future lives we have the material wherewithal that we need to be able to practice. You can see that if we're not generous in this life and we don't create that karma, we may have a marvelous opportunity, and be near great teachers in future lives, but we don't have any resources, so we have to go to work, so we can't, go to teachings, we can't do all sorts of other things, because we have to go to work just to even get the bread and tea for us to eat. Okay, so we need to create the far-reaching generosity. Then to second one, is to make use of the resources. We actually need a precious human life. And so the cause of an upper rebirth is ethical conduct. So that's the second of perfection. Okay? So it's refraining from harming others. Yeah? And then that, the more we're able to live in precepts and refrain from harming others, then it's easier to get a human life. And then if we have, we've created generosity, then we have resources. So that's a good basis. if you create generosity but you don't create ethics, then you wind up as one of the cats. Okay? At the cat in an American monastery. If you create neither ethics nor generosity, you wind up as a dog in an Asian monastery. The dogs, in South India, they suffer incredibly. Yeah. The monks feed them with extra food, but they all have mange, And it's really difficult for the dogs there. Okay, then the third one is, we have a human life, we have the resources. We also need good companions to practice the Dharma with. Yeah? We can't just kind of go and do everything by ourselves. We need to, we need to have a good personality. We need good companions to practice with. Yeah? Because otherwise, even if we go to teachings, if we're an obnoxious, argumentative person, nobody's going to want us there in the teachings. Yeah? And, you go somewhere and you just argue and whatever and argue all the time, then people don't want you to be around. It's true, isn't it? Yeah? And so in that case, that limits your ability to practice the Dharma because, if you're really obnoxious, sometimes even the teachers don't have the patience for you. So we like to think of all the teachers as being extremely patient, but sometimes, we can be really obnoxious. Yeah, and they're just like, oh, get this one away. Yeah. So how do we have a good personality? How do we create the cause to have Dharma companions? By practicing fortitude, by not getting angry. Yeah. So you can see it, can't you? Yeah. If we're an angersome person in this life, we develop the habit of being, angry, losing our temper, complaining, criticizing, nitpicking. And that just goes into the next life. And then people are like, you want to volunteer? We don't need your volunteer work right now. Yeah, it just becomes difficult. Whereas if we really, in this life, practice fortitude and develop a pleasant personality where we're not always getting angry and criticizing, complaining and so on, then that habit will, continue into future lives. Then whenever there's Dharma groups or whatever, we will be very welcomed into them and we'll be able to practice together with others. And practicing together with others is very helpful, isn't it, in our practice? Yeah? Don't you find practicing with others helpful? Yeah, especially if you don't have the discipline, let's say, to keep a schedule. When there's a schedule and then everybody's doing the same thing, then you just do the same thing along with everybody else. And it really helps you practice. And then you have friends to talk to, and you can give them tips and they can give you tips and you can share things. It's Dharma friends, I think, are quite important for us. Okay, then also, that's another thing for future lives that will aid our practice in future life. Then in future life with our precious human life, with our resources, with a pleasant personality, then we need to be able to complete whatever we set out to do. Yeah? And so we need joyous effort. So you see that many people, they may want to, they may want to do a retreat, but they do a little bit and then they get discouraged, they get tired, whatever, they stop. Or you want to do some kind of virtuous project, that would benefit sentient beings. You start, you make some plans, then you stop. So we can look, and we may be some of those people, where we have, we start so many things and we don't finish very many of them. Yeah. So what this does is it sets the pattern in our mind. It creates the karma. So again, in future lives, we start many things, start many Dharma practices. You know, we want to do our Nundro. We do 100 Vajrasattva mantras. Then we don't complete that. Then we go on to do refuge. We do 1,000 of those. We don't complete that. We start prostration. We do a few hundred of that. We don't complete that. Then we, you know? So if we don't complete something, then it just sets up the cause in future lives not to complete things. And we can see that if we don't complete our practices, if we set out to benefit sentient beings, and we start a project, but then we throw up our hands in the middle and quit, you know, then our virtue is greatly limited, isn't it? And the ability to really benefit others in the long term is greatly limited, because we get burnt out, we get discouraged, we get fed up. Okay, so joyous effort is really important. And you know, you can look around and see that the people who really have joyous effort, I mean, some of you who are here, I've known you for like, what, 20 years, over 20 years, yeah? And you've been coming to Dharma regularly for 20 years, and you've gone through ups, and you've gone through downs, and you keep coming back, and you keep on with your practice, you know? You don't kind of just, you know, like, oh, this is just too much, you know? Yeah, but you really hang in there, and that's incredible virtue, really. I'm so respectful, you know, those of you who do that. And it sets up the habit in future lives to be able to continue along that line. Yeah. Okay, so to be successful, you know, in creating virtue in future lives, we need to be able to finish things, so we practice joyous effort in this life. So these alone are not sufficient. If we have lots of afflictions in future lives, then we again create more negative karma. Okay, so we need to develop meditative stability and concentration. So because that settles the mind down, it subdues the mind, it makes it peaceful, and it makes it so we aren't distracted all over the place. Okay? So we may have all sorts of other good conditions, but if our mind isn't peaceful, is filled with distractions, afflictions easily arise. You know, if we practice the methods to attain concentration, then, you know, when you have, shamatha, then the manifest afflictions don't arise when you're in a state of meditation. And the more you, shamatha is like the basic thing. You haven't even entered the first jhana at that point. But as you develop deeper and deeper meditative states, the mind gets more and more peaceful. The manifest afflictions really get subdued. Then that gives you so much freedom. Yeah, you haven't eliminated the afflictions, because concentration alone can't eliminate the afflictions, but it makes the mind more peaceful. So if we can have a more peaceful mind, less distracted mind now, then in future lives, wow, wouldn't that be nice? Yeah? To not have such a crazy, you know, bananas mind. So that's why we need to practice meditative stability for a precious human life in the next. And then in future lives, we also need to be able to discriminate between good teachers and misleading teachers. We need to be able to discriminate what to practice and what to abandon. If we don't understand what is virtue and what is non-virtue, we can do a lot of things thinking we're creating virtue, but we're actually creating non-virtue. Yeah, if we can't tell, you know, what are the qualities of a good teacher versus, you know, somebody who may be very entertaining and very charismatic, but, you know, not so scrupulous. So we need wisdom. Yeah, because wisdom enables us to see, you know, what are the qualities of a good teacher, so we can be on the lookout for good teachers, stay away from misleading ones. Wisdom enables us to understand what is virtue, what is non-virtue, what to practice, what to abandon. Okay? So you can see in a very practical way how these six perfections really help us in the next life to become a better practitioner who can practice more easily. Yeah? Without problems due to resources, problems due to, you know, people not liking us, problems due to not being able to complete things, problems due to having a very unruly mind, problems, you know, of not being able to discriminate what to practice and abandon. Yeah? Because we can look around sometimes, you know, and we can see people who have many, many good circumstances. But if they miss one, it's like the others can't be fully utilized. And it's such a tragedy. Yeah? And I think that's the case for many sentient beings. Yeah. So really having all of these is quite rare. Yeah. But if we work at creating the causes for it, then, because cause and effect always works, then those kind of effects will come about. Okay? So then we practice, there's an order to the way these six are presented. Yeah, so we need generosity in order to keep ethical conduct, because a big obstacle to keeping ethical conduct is attachment to possessions. So we practice generosity first, that makes ethical conduct easier. We need ethical conduct to develop fortitude, because with ethical conduct, we can begin to control our afflictions, so that makes it easier to be calm when we face difficulties. Okay, we need fortitude in order to gain joyous effort, because with fortitude, we can be calm in difficult situations, and that enables us to maintain joyous effort in our practice. Whereas if we can't be calm in difficulties, then our joyous effort's out the window. Okay, we need joyous effort to have concentration, because we need to effort over time in order to develop concentration. It's not going to come quickly and easily. And we need concentration in order to develop wisdom, because to have wisdom, we need a stable mind. We can't have a monkey mind. Okay? So there's lots and lots of things that they use to describe, you know, the six, and, you know, like how you practice all six together with one. Yeah, so like if you're practicing generosity, then you practice ethical conduct, you know, with generosity, by giving something that's going to benefit somebody, not, you know, by not giving something that will cause damage to that person or damage to somebody else. You practice ethical conduct with fortitude, because if the person isn't appreciative, you don't blow up at them. And also you're willing to go through difficulties in order to be generous. You practice joyous effort with generosity by really taking delight in being generous, having a happy mind to do it. Because if you don't have a happy mind, you're not going to continue to be generous. We practice meditative stability with generosity, because the meditative stability enables us to have a peaceful mind when practicing generosity, and it enables us to also keep our bodhicitta motivation stable, so that when we're practicing generosity, you know, we have a stable motivation. We practice wisdom with generosity by remembering that the giver, the action of giving, the recipient, the gift, that all these are dependent, that they are empty of true existence, but exist in a mutually dependent way. Okay? And so you can apply, you can pick any of the others. That's just an example of how you do it with generosity. But you can pick any of the other ones and then think about how to practice the other five perfections together when you're principally dwelling on this one. Okay? Questions? Comments? Yeah?
When does a precious human life begin? If we aren't born with all of the conditions for a precious human life, can't those manifest later in life?
Hmm. Yeah, I think that sometimes you can be born, let's say, without resources, yeah? Or when you're an infant, you know, you don't have faith in the Dharma, something like that. But then later, you know, maybe things change and, you know, you start to have the resources you need to practice. You develop faith in the Dharma. You could also start out being in a very rich family and then everything falls apart, you know. The stock market goes down and then you lose that. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have spoken of this, and it was true for me too, and probably many people in the room, where our very first Dharma teacher mm-hmm. was an authentic teacher. And, but mm-hmm. when you're very, very new, you know, there's just not the time to learn what to look for. That comes in the Lam Rim. And so is that just a case of making aspirations in the previous life that you, or is it, how does it happen that someone else who has all these good qualities ends up in a tradition that's wacko?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So some of us have had the experience, the first Dharma teaching we go to is by a really wonderful teacher. I mean, that was, I went to one talk before by somebody, but never followed up on that. But then basically my first teachers were Lama and Rinpoche, and it was like, wow, you can't wind up much better than this. And I was totally innocent. I didn't know what qualities of a good teacher were. I didn't know what to look for, you know. Why did I happen to meet these teachers who were really excellent, you know, whereas other people we know met, you know, Jim Jones or even within Buddhism, you know, some teacher who's, why is that? I think that it must come because of having made very strong dedication prayers in previous lives, you know. So when you really make strong prayers to meet with reliable teachers and authentic teachers, because you see the importance of that, and you make strong dedication prayers never to meet with, you know, unqualified teachers, or even you happen to meet these people, to never become interested or associated with them. I think it's really the force of those kind of aspirational prayers. You know, Geshe Thakchok was saying that in his comment, you know, when he was talking about Precious Garland, that he was commenting how there's different prayers that are written, you know, where we aspire to always meet, like in the King of Prayers, mm-hmm. you know? So we generate that kind of aspiration, and that, I think that kind of dedication is so important, because at the very beginning, if you meet a way out teacher, you know, yeah, very, very difficult, very difficult. I remember at one of these Western Buddhist teachers' meetings, sometimes you hear the most amazing stories at these meetings. Anyway, you know, many people have been, this was some years ago, so they were talking about various scandals that were going on in the Buddhist community. And I remember talking to Alex Burson, and, you know, we have many of the same teachers, Sintram Sukham Rinpoche, Geshe Nawan Dorje and His Holiness, and many others. And Alex and I were talking, and like, how come we have, like, the most excellent teachers, and we're hearing all these stories from other people that are just amazing about what's going on, you know? And how is it that we manage, and we were just, you know, really kind of exemplifies the need to make those kinds of prayers and aspirations. Because I don't know about you, when I started out the Dharma, I didn't know anything. I was totally innocent, totally gullible. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So, very important to meet good teachers.
Mm-hmm. What's the best way to create the cause to meet the Dharma at a young age in our next lifetime?
Cause to meet the Dharma in a young age at our next lifetime. Start practicing very well now. Don't say, I'll practice later on in my life. Okay? You know, first of all, make prayers to meet the Dharma when you're young. But also, whatever age you are right now, put your mind really into the Dharma. Because if you don't do that, and you say, well, I have time in the future, I'll practice later for, you know, right now I'm busy doing this and this and this, and I'll practice later. Then, here you met the Dharma when you were whatever age you met it in now, but you're not making use of it, which is like creating the cause to meet it later, you know, in a future life. You see what I'm saying? How it, yeah? So start your practice now. Your questions? Yeah.
More of a comment, I guess. Uh-huh. You're going through these number 35 through 46.
Mm-hmm.
Except for one. They all seemed rather complicated, actually.
Yeah, the last one is the only one that I'll never, that I won't break.
Yeah, well, that one I didn't even include, but the one about rejoicing for others, that seemed easiest.
Uh-huh.
Because it just seemed less complicated. But all the other ones, in terms of benefiting others, really seemed complicated. And I was just pondering, like, how are we ever going to get to this place of actually benefiting others? But I think that it really helped the part when you were teaching about how all the six perfections support each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is complicated. People are complicated, situations are complicated, and we need something that's larger than one trait.
Yeah,
you know.
Right. Yeah. So those ones at the end, they're all just short phrases, aren't they, of how to enact the welfare for others. But doing them is difficult. You know, overcoming our reticence, our laziness, our disgust, or, you know, who knows, whatever. And the way you learn about that is just by jumping in and doing them. And we make mistakes and we learn from our mistakes. Yeah. But then, like you said, having some broad view about all the different paramitas and how they can all come to play in a situation is really, really helpful. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
About auxiliary vow 42.
Number what?
42. 42, the one about helping people in your circle of friends, disciples.
Uh-huh.
The Dharma Center I support is not the one in my town, but one that's far away, because that's the one I feel a connection with. Is that okay?
Oh, of course. Of course. Yeah.
I have a question that's related. That I've been puzzling over this line, this verse in the Foundation of All Good Qualities that says, generating the altruistic attention among without cultivating three ethical practices does not lead to awakening. I'm wondering how, and then it goes on to so practice the Bodhisattva does, but how can you even generate the altruistic intention without the three ethical practices? What is he talking about?
Okay, so what page is that? Okay. Okay.
In the blue book.
Yeah. Generating the altruistic intention alone without cultivation of the three ethical practices does not lead to awakening. Okay, so your question is, how can you even generate bodhicitta without the three? This is one of those cases, you know, when it's with the way it's worded, we start thinking, okay, first you do this, and you don't start the second one until this one's completed. And as you pointed out, it's not that case. Of course you need some of the of ethical conduct before in order to generate bodhicitta. The perfection of ethical conduct is the ethical conduct you do motivated by bodhicitta, so that you have to have bodhicitta beforehand. And it also has the, you know, some of the wisdom aspect to it. So clearly you need ethical conduct in order to generate bodhicitta, but you need bodhicitta in order to fulfill the perfection of ethical conduct. Okay? So sometimes, you know, I mean, even when they say the Lamrim and we hear about the order of the things in Lamrim, sometimes we get the idea, well, first, all you do is meditate on this one. You don't think of any of the other things. You just meditate on this one, and you realize this one, and then you go on to the next one. They actually say that there's a way of teaching the Lamrim like that. But in actual fact, it's much better to have a whole understanding, because by practicing things at the end of the path, it helps you actualize things at the beginning. And practicing the things at the beginning helps you actualize the things at the end. So I find, you know, sometimes when we have a list, we don't see that the things in the list overlap. Yeah. But in actual fact, I mean, life is not messy. Life is complicated. Things overlap. Things don't go in nice, discrete little categories. Okay? Okay, then we'll dedicate.
May the spiritual teacher soon lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Bodhisattva's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Idam gura namandala kamyatayami.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds
of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, whose spread a view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the west flow.